your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a very special guest this evening, John Podesh. He's written a heck of a good book. It's about drugs as weapons against us. Welcome to our program, John Podesh.
Thanks for having me on, George.
Well, I tell you what, John, after looking over your book and everything, you really covered the waterfront. Tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Sure. Yeah, I've been working as a counselor for over 25 years, working with people with mental health problems and addictions for over 25 years. And so I've heard a lot of stories, personal stories and full biography, full autobiographies of people, of course, and intakes and then long-term counseling. And that gave me some inside information that led me to research some of what I researched. I was also involved in activism and studied with a Columbia University professor named Richard Cloward, a great sociologist who won a Lifetime Achievement Award in sociology. And he gave me more insight into what was going on, and along with long-term activism and research for over the 25 years, gave me a lot of new information about how, as I titled my book, Drugs Are Used as Weapons Against Us. The title of the book is Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists.
Right. You seem to indicate in your book about this opium trafficking families. I guess it goes back to the British East India Company, does it not?
Yeah, it does. Where, British families that were involved in that trade became incredibly wealthy from that trade and started banks such as HSBC, Hong Kong, Shanghai Banking Corporation, which is considered the largest bank in Europe. And the American families that were connected to that opium shipping were the Pierponts and the Russells. And, of course, the Pierponts, part of Julius Pierpont Morgan's family. And that's why J.P. Morgan Chase is considered by Forbes the top bank in the world.
Right. So it's not, I know your book focuses in on the drug aspect of this, but these are families that have extended their interest into banking and industry and everything. Is that true?
Sure. Yeah, it is. I mean, what I show is how drugs, props up a lot of banking and a lot of stock market and gives an advantage to, these families that got involved in banking. And so the drug market made them such huge profits that it led them and their associated families to have huge power and wealth in the world.
Yeah, so you're saying that these drugs really gave an added profit to their banking industry, which they were already doing. And then they had to laundry that money into there? Is this what? And their banks, so they just did it into their own banks. Is that right?
Right, right. I mean, you tell in the last about 5 years how many banks were caught laundering money, and just all, many of the major banks were caught laundering drug money. But this has been going on for so many years. And a Wall Street insider named Catherine Austin Fitz has shown how it actually artificially inflates the values of stocks by 20 times. When you get a certain amount of cash inflow into the income of a company, a company on the stock market, it makes it look like that amount of increase in revenue is going to maintain itself for 20 years. And so the offering price of the stock can go up by a multiple of 20 based on just pure, you know, cash inflow. And so that's just one of the ways that it props up the stock market to be artificially, you know, high in value.
Right. Right. You know, Catherine Austin Fitz has the insight to this secret money or this hidden money dynamics. And so she adds a great deal to the study of this. Also, you're talking here about MK Ultra. Tell us a little bit about that. Some of our listening audience knows bits and pieces of this, but it's good to refresh their memory about MK Ultra.
Sure. So it's interesting that these families had founded the eugenics movement in the 1900s in the United States, which was the most bigoted genocidal movement this country's ever seen, and was actually funding the Nazis when they rose to power. And so in the same offices in Cold Spring Harbor, after World War II, the MKUltra program was founded by the CIA. And the CIA actually brought in, saved a number of Nazis that were experimenting with using drugs on concentration camp survivors in Germany, and brought them over through Operation Paperclip to the United States to work at this Cold Spring Harbor. And so MKUltra's operations tested many drugs on Edgewood Arsenal soldiers and hospital patients and a number of different people, prison populations. And they were testing these drugs to use them as warfare, okay? And that's the kind of framework and basis of drugs as weapons against us, is that this MK Ultra was testing as many drugs as possible to use as warfare. And I show the evidence that it wasn't just warfare with countries abroad, but it was also warfare on its own population. And that's been the pattern of countries, is not only warfare abroad, but warfare on the kind of the 99% who oppose the machinations of the 1% wealthiest, you know, that control our country.
Right. So you're saying that these drugs undermine and debase a society, and then the society's more easily manipulated by these elitists. Is that sort of the ploy or the?
Exactly. And of all these drugs, it turns out that LSD became the most focused one. And I show the some of the excerpts from government documents that say they believe that using LSD and disseminating LSD can allow people to be more easily manipulated. And there's other studies that show that it can cause some mild damage that can last for, you know, at least short periods of time, if not moderate, you know, middle, kind of like longer periods of time. For myself, I probably ate a half dozen hits of acid in college and saw my grades drop drastically for about a year. It took me, you know, a year to start bringing those grades up again, and luckily I could. But, yes, I found at least four studies that were clear that some damage was being caused by LSD, and they just couldn't pinpoint exactly what. And then a number of other studies that showed that certain people were susceptible to some psychosis from long-term LSD use, of course. And people like Kurt Vonnegut's son, Mark Vonnegut, wrote a book about how after his about fourth or fifth hit, it just triggered a psychotic episode in himself. And he was in a mental institution for about a year before he came out and wrote a book about it called Eden Express. And so, you know, obviously this LSD was causing some problems. And there's evidence, there's a good book called Acid Dreams by Fairness and Accuracy and reporter founder Martin Lee, which shows now, many of these MK Ultra operatives, including the director Sidney Gottlieb, were spreading acid around the world, using it. They had a kind of leftist hit list to target leaders around the world with acid, including people like Abdel Nasser of Egypt, Che Guevara and Castro, etc. And so, yeah, that's some of the ways that these drugs were used as weapons.
Right. You get into Ken Kesey. He was involved in what, spreading the use of LSD during that era, that period?
Yeah, he was an interesting figure because I focus on two different chapters that come in a row. I focus on Timothy Leary and Ken Kesey. And I show the evidence that Timothy Leary was first duped into using acid But then after that, I mean, Timothy Leary was running one of 100 different programs around the country. I mean, colleges over 100 countries around the country, 100 colleges around the country were running programs experimenting with psychedelics when volunteer students, offering them money to use psychedelics and seeing what happened. This was granted to these colleges through the Human Ecology Fund, which was a CIA front company. So these professors that were getting this money around the country didn't realize that this money was actually coming from the CIA because of this front company, the Human Ecology Fund. And so so Leary was doing that. And so I don't believe at that time he knew that this was CIA money he was getting. Then a interesting figure named Michael Hollingshead comes into his life and gives him a 3 days worth hit of acid. He gave him enough acid to be tripping for 3 straight days.
Oh, my gosh. And so,
yeah, and so he really messed Leary's mind up. And Leary's colleagues just said they thought he turned into a jelly from that and was following Hollingshead around like a puppy after that. And Hollingshead was a propaganda agent for the British intelligence. And Hollingshead had formerly been stationed right next to the United Nations and would hold parties where he would spread acid all over his furniture and invite United Nations dignitaries over, and they'd instantly be tripping at his party because they would touch the furniture with acid on it. So Hollingshead was obviously doing agent work himself for likely the Tavistock Institute in Britain, which was doing similar work as MKUltra in the United States. And so once Hollingshead had Leary in this state of mind, Leary ended up doing his bidding, and they both kind of convinced the colleagues that also trip, including Ralph Metzner and the guy that he changed his name to Baba Ram Das. I forgot his original name, Alpert. His name was Alpert. And so they all started tripping regularly. They were originally using psychedelic mushrooms on the students with the Human Ecology Fund money. But then they started using acid, for student volunteers, giving them acid. And eventually Harvard kicked them out for some of the things they were doing. But Leary ended up admitting that he realized he was working for the CIA, and he continued working for the CIA. And he ended up following through on CIA operations such as getting close with the Weather Underground and then ratting on them. And going over to the Panthers in Exile compound in Algeria, where Eldridge Cleaver and his wife Kathleen Cleaver were having a Panther encampment in Algeria, and brought I think it was 20,000 to 30,000 hits of acid over there. Tripping, yeah. So Leary did carry out operations. Now Ken Kesey is a different story, I argue. Because Kesey did go through an MKUltra test, a volunteer test, when he was a poor graduate student at the Stanford Writing Program. Kesey was a exceptional wrestler. He was an alternate on the Olympic wrestling team, a national champion. He said he never even smoked weed at that time. He barely even ever got drunk in his life at that time. And here he was, poor, and just offered $150, or the equivalent of $150 at that time, to do this experiment. And so he did it, and they had him tripping a lot. They used a lot of acid on him or whatever, different psychedelics on him at this experiment. After that, they offered him a job at that same hospital. And I argue that they pretended that, they gave him the keys to the hospital to be a janitor there, and that's where he got some of the fodder for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, his famous book. But he thought that they just accidentally gave him the keys and that he could get into the storage for all the LSD. And so he stole all the LSD he could. He kept stealing the LSD and kept having parties, LSD parties, at his house around the Stanford Writing Program. And they became bigger and bigger and more popular and more popular. And they eventually turned into the acid test, but not before. And so I suggest that maybe this wasn't just an accidental, allowing him to steal all this acid for years, but they actually allowed him to do this because they thought this is, they were manipulating him this way. But that's uncertain. Now, I argue that Kesey was duped into all this, and that Kesey didn't know that he was being used by U.S. intelligence. Because what ended up happening is people around Kesey had a lot, there was at least several people that just came right out of the military and became part of Kesey's group as part of the pranksters. And they ended up making the psychedelic bus. They painted this this bus in psychedelic colors. One of the key people around that was a guy named Augustus Owsley. His actually full name was Augustus Owsley Stanley III. He came from super wealthy family in the Kentucky area who were senators and judges and, and so he ends up, he's in the military himself. He comes out of the military and he's producing both speed and manufacturing speed and LSD in the San Francisco area in the early 1960s. Kesey ends up stopping from stealing the acid and ends up getting all this acid from Owsley. And Owsley funds this, bus to go across the country. It goes through civil rights areas of the South before it ends up in New York, where Kesey had an event going on for his second book. And they end up going to Harlem, where there was the recent riots with, and they're proselytizing for LSD. And they come back to San Francisco, and they hold the acid tests. And one of the top MK Ultra scientists, John Gittinger, said in a legal deposition that me and two other scientists were at least several of these first early acid tests. Okay, and so what were they doing there? I argue it's no coincidence that they were there. They were running an experiment with those acid tests.
Right.
And I think Kesey knew that he was being experimented on. He tried to shut down the acid tests after about the third one, and was and other people had different plans.
Right. Dr. Jolly West, did that pop up in your studies and your research at all?
Yes. Yeah, he was a very ugly.
How does he weaves his way in and out of all of these people that have done assassinations? You know what I mean? It's unimaginable the people that he. But he's out of UCLA, I understand, but also the Stanford Research Institute figured into a lot of this testing and stuff during that period. But what do you have on Jolly West? Tell us about that.
Well, he was unbelievably racist. I mean, put across these, he was trying to do experiments on young black males because he said that they were inherently violent and inherently, and so he was involved with the acid manufacturer or acid. He was involved in the whole acid scene in various ways is all I can say. I don't know if it was actually manufacturer, but he was involved with some of the same figures that were involved with the acid test and MKUltra. He was employed by the government. He put across all these racist theories. And he also, I understand, was somehow connected to the JFK assassination. Is that right?
Lee Harvey Oswald, he interviewed him. Well, actually, it wasn't, I don't think it was Lee Harvey Oswald, but it was Jack Ruby he interviewed in jail in Dallas.
Right, and said he's crazy. Yeah. Because he won't admit that he's crazy, he must be crazy, I think was his verdict on that, interview. And so West is obviously was a ugly, bigoted tool of U.S. intelligence. And was involved in a number of operations like that. And so I have the Kennedys in my book also because of the fact that there was a doctor, he was called Max Feelgood Jacobson, that was regularly giving shots to President John F. Kennedy. And people argue that, some biographers argue that those shots were full of either speed and or cocaine, and that he was addicting JFK and trying to, manipulate him and control him that way. Also with Robert Kennedy. Now, JFK tried to end MKUltra, and Richard Helms kept it going behind JFK's back. So that was another reason, motive for them wanting to get rid of JFK, because he was trying to dismantle CIA operations such as MKUltra and a number of other operations. And, to go on.
Yeah, there was a study done at Stanford Research Institute in 82 called Changing Images of Man. Are you familiar with that?
No, I don't know that.
But you bring to the forefront a great deal of research in the drug thing. But on the mental side or the psychological side, they started debasing the country and trying to change it and transform it to much more of a new age type of mentality.
I can believe that, sure.
And the Changing Images of Man was a research put out by all of these people there. Joseph Campbell, mm-hmm. All those people like that came in on this research. And they set out a series of good images of man that they wanted to downplay, and then other images they wanted to upplay.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah.
What that would add a great deal later to another book for you or something. But what you've done here is the most articulate, detailed study of this that I have ever read before. And your knowledge of this, you know, the Jolly West, you know, the Ken Kesey. And one point about Timothy Leary, okay?
Yeah.
Before we get too far down the interview here, is Timothy Leary pioneered in personality theory at Harvard.
Right.
He had what they call the circle, okay? I don't know if you've ever seen it. But it represented by colors also. The northwest quadrant of the circle was orange or red, which represented a very psychopathic, aggressive personality type. Okay? Yeah. An authoritarian personality type. The opposite would be on the opposite to the east side or to the lower side. I think the top half of the circle was very aggressive, and as you proceeded down to the lower hemisphere, it was less aggressive. But anyway, one of the theories that we've entertained, myself and Eric Samuelson, over the years, and we've studied a lot of this stuff in depth, is that Timothy Leary was way ahead in personality typing. And all of a sudden, he's recruited into all of this deal. I don't know if they targeted him to move him away from his studies or what.
I could believe that. That makes sense. Sure.
See, because he was pioneering in this. Now, they took his knowledge, what I mean, the CIA did, and integrated it with their previous research and stuff. Now, what you touch on in this book is that you talk about paperclip, okay?
Yeah.
How about Martin Bormann? Nazis in Exile was a book written back in 82, I think.
Yeah.
Do you have anything about how they brought some of these Nazis after World War II to the country, this country, and South America?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do have a chapter on that, and that's more controversial, of course. But I think it was there was some top journalists in this country, and it was one of Murrow's. Edward Murrow was one of the top journalists.
Yeah, Edward R. Murrow's one of his broadcasters wrote that book, Nazi in Exile.
Right. Now, so he went to great lengths to investigate that Nazis in Exile and to uncover all that was done with Bormann going down to Argentina. And he said in that book, Nazis in Exile, that these Germans, Nazi exiles had, there's about 80 families that each had over 100,000 acres of land down in Argentina. It's incredible how much land they had down there. And so I, with Operation Sunrise, I show in one chapter of my book, they got all these Nazis, thousands of Nazis, and a lot of this has come out in even mainstream places like New York Times recently. They got thousands of Nazis down to Latin America. And I show the evolution of what they were doing with those Nazis down in South America. Because they ran those Nazis, such as the Butcher of Lyon, Klaus Barbie. He was in Bolivia. He was stationed in Bolivia. He ran a German colony in Bolivia. A Nazi doctor named Schaefer just came out in the New York Times within the past about 10 years, 15 years. I think it was in 2006 they came out with this, that he had started a Nazi colony in Chile. And that colony they revealed had a huge amount of intelligence files on all of the leftists in Chile. They also had a huge amount of armaments, a government's worth of armaments in this one colony of Chile. And they also had their own airspace, like a country within a country, where Chile was not allowed to fly over the German colony's airspace inside of Chile. And this was Schaefer ran this colony, and so there was loads of Nazis in that colony. So we come to find that what they're doing is they were propping up cocaine drug traffickers and causing what was called cocaine coups, such as in Bolivia, where Covert Action Quarterly, a good whistleblowing magazine started by CIA whistleblower Phil Agee, showed a picture of a Nazi flag flying on top of a mountain in the Andes during the cocaine coup that toppled a democratically elected head of Bolivia. So this is what and so I was going to say the Butcher of Lyon, Klaus Barbie helped lead that coup. Barbie also helped lead the murder of Che Guevara when Che Guevara was trying to do things in Bolivia. And he did it on behalf, and these Nazis were doing this on behalf of the CIA, because the CIA then got a lot of these Nazis and these cooperating countries where the Nazis took control to run Operation Condor. They helped lead the overthrow of the Nazi colony, but run by Schaefer, helped lead the toppling of Salvador Allende in Chile, you know, the leftist leader that was elected by people in 1971. And so Chile and Argentina became the centers of Operation Condor, and then spread to about nine Latin American countries. And they proceeded to assassinate any leftists worldwide, you know, and kill tens of thousands in each of their countries. And they were also involved in the cocaine trafficking, and I argue they still are today, the descendants of these Nazis.
So, you know, in pre-Nazi Germany, there was a struggle between the communist and the Nazi. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is just like a continuation after World War II of that struggle?
Probably, yeah. I wouldn't even say, you know, yeah, it could be communists or it could be just leftists in general. They're just struggling against anyone who's against their hyper-capitalism and their fascist.
What, John, comes to my mind sometimes is, you know, the 007 of novels?
Yeah.
You know, they had an organization called Spectre in there.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was an international crime cartel or syndicate called Spectre. Uh-huh. It's what's happened today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, these people are into banking and they're into the drug end of it. And it's just bigger than ever. And, boy, I just don't know how we're going to extract ourselves from these tentacles, so to speak. You talk in your book about some of the LSD stuff that was provided to some of the different musical people. And, in fact, you said that Janis Joplin, she's out of Austin and Port Arthur area way back, was provided acid and amphetamines. And so what were they going after, people that were in opposition to them or they could see as a opposing force or what?
Yeah, the biographies on Janis Joplin show that this guy who entered Janis Joplin's life when she was a rising star after she came from Austin and went to San Francisco, she was considered people knew she was going to be a huge star. She had such great talent, Janis Joplin. And so a guy entered her life and proceeded to romance her and gave her loads of speed and got her hooked on speed. And this guy ended up admitting to someone else that he had been working for the FBI at one point and that he was also involved in international pharmaceutical work and all this different kinds of work that was basic U.S. intelligence work, you know. It's hard to explain all the different operations this guy was involved in, but they were all sure signs that he did work for U.S. intelligence. And so he hooks her on speed. He lies to her again and again. It turns out he's got a whole other family somewhere else while he's engaged to Janis Joplin. She's, you know, distraught and ends up breaking up with him when she finds out he has a whole other family somewhere else. But he was a ugly, nefarious guy in her life that I argue was the first person to start trying to manipulate her. And so she ends up addicted to certain drugs. She actually hated LSD, though. She hated acid. She was one of the few people that completely rejected it after just one time trying it. But she ends up getting hooked on heroin, and she was trying to get off of heroin. She'd gotten points of sobriety when she agreed and she announced on national talk shows that she was going to do the first major concerts for peace. They're going to be held at several stadiums in different, at least two stadiums in two major cities, first in New York and then in Philadelphia. And it was actually the first major concerts dedicated to peace with the Vietnam War and getting out of the Vietnam War. And when just before the first one she was supposed to do, she got a hot shot, meaning extremely pure dose of LSD. I mean, not LSD, I'm sorry, but heroin. Extremely pure dose of heroin. And that's, you know, in the CIA manuals for assassination, they, you know, one of the tactics they talk about is giving people a hot shot to make it look like an accidental death when it's really an assassination of an important figure, you know, such as, you know, musicians, because other intelligence documents talk about using drugs against musicians.
Well, yeah, you make a very important point there. This was during the anti-war movement, so the government was moving against those people, and she was a leading member of the anti-war movement.
She was becoming that for sure, yes.
She was building to that, and plus with her ability to attract millions of followers, right? Well, they didn't want that.
No doubt. Huh? And that's why, actually, another major figure that actually died before her was the founder of the Rolling Stones, Brian Jones. And he's an interesting figure, and the Rolling Stones in general are very important to look at regarding the use of drugs as weapons against us, because of the fact that Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor, A.E. Hotchner, wrote a book called Blown Away about the Rolling Stones. And in that book, he said in 1965, the assistant deputy director of the CIA, Robert Lashbrook, went to London and proceeded to have his agents spread LSD to all the musicians they could. And so why were they doing that is the question. And so why did, later in that book, did Mick Jagger's girlfriend, Marianne Faithfull, say that Jagger resisted using LSD for years while other members of the band were using it? In 1967, he still hadn't used LSD and actually was suing a paper for suggesting that he had. And all of a sudden, an undercover FBI agent, now in the book it doesn't say this guy's an undercover FBI agent, but it came out later in the newspapers about that after this book was published. But a guy named Dave Schneiderman, as he called himself Dave Jobe at that time, came to this party with loads of drugs, including acid. And he finally got Mick Jagger to try his first hit of acid there at that party. And so then the police raided the party later, got Jagger arrested and Richards arrested for trumped-up charges, and they didn't arrest Schneiderman, even though he's got a briefcase full of all kinds of drugs, including acid. And he just argued. Schneiderman said, oh, well, I've got film in there, and if you open up my briefcase, I'll expose the film. So they let him go. And I argue it was all set up that way. And Jagger was then set up again. He actually caught a member of the police on film planting drugs in his car. But they had Jagger under their thumb legally from that point forward. And they had Richards under their thumb. They also did similar stuff with Brian Jones, where Brian Jones was, under the legal authority's thumb. And when the Stones went to tour in the United States, Britain denied Jones a passport to go or a visa to come to the United States. So the Stones had to temporarily kick Jones out of the band, just saying, well, you know, we'll see when we get back from this tour. We'll try to reconnect with you, but we're not sure right now what's going on. So Jones ends up sobering up. He cleans himself up. He ends up calling John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix. And A.E. Hotchner says that he got agreements from Jimi Hendrix and John Lennon, because they were all friends, to form a new group, a super group. And just after that, Jones is drowned in his own swimming pool, according to eyewitnesses. A member of the Guinness family was a good friend of Brian Jones. And remember, Brian Jones is the best instrumentalist in the Rolling Stones, and he's the founder of the Rolling Stones. And he was adamantly against the Vietnam War, as was Mick Jagger. And he was saying that publicly. So Jones ends up, this member of the Guinness family says he's sent by Jones out to the town to pick up a friend. He comes back and all of a sudden there's a party at Jones' place, or when it's supposed to be a party, and he can't get into the Jones' estate. It's blocked off. He walks around the back and he sees someone being drowned in Brian Jones' swimming pool. And someone pops out of the bushes and says, get out of here, and calls the Guinness family guys by his name. He says, get out of here, you'll be next. And he says he was scared to death to say anything about it until many years later when he wrote about it in his own book. But he found out, he saw Brian Jones being drowned. It was Brian Jones who was getting drowned in his own swimming pool. even though people.
But what year was that, John? That Jones passed away.
1968.
68, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. I was in West Berlin listening to the Rolling Stones in 66 of January. I'll never forget. I was over there at a little bar early one morning across from the Andrews Barracks where we were stationed. But so I go back with them pretty far. Yeah, I grew up, you know, with the Beatles and all that stuff. So any of these anti-war musicians were targets. And so it looks overwhelming. There's just too many of them, so it wasn't by accident, right?
It's what it appears. I mean, at the same time that Lashbrook, the assistant deputy director of the CIA, was spreading acid to musicians, John Lennon got his first hit of acid via George Harrison's dentist. George Harrison's dentist invites John Lennon and George Harrison over for dinner and then spikes their coffee with acid. And George Harrison said, "What's LSD?" He didn't even know what it was at that time. And Lennon was furious that the dentist did that. And it's unbelievable that a guy would do that in that day and age when John Lennon and George Harrison are already super wealthy. You know, they're already famous in 1965. And George Harrison didn't even know what it was. They could have sued this dentist. But this dentist obviously did it because he thought he was immune from being sued. He was immune from legal repercussions from something like this. So this is just the pattern of how it ends up happening with political musicians.
Now, during the Vietnam War, there was the Golden Triangle was operative, and they were bringing a lot of drugs out there from out of there. What do you have on that?
John Stockwell was a former CIA agent, station chief, and I talked to him in 1990, and he told me he was personally, flying shipments of opium and heroin from the Golden Triangle in Vietnam to the United States. And so he knew about those operations personally. And he said, it can be argued that one of the biggest reasons for the Vietnam War was, one of the top reasons was to get at that best area of opium cultivation, of, poppy field cultivation, which was the Golden Triangle at one end of a mountain range. Now, at the other end of that mountain range is the Golden Crescent of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so, it just shows that our two longest running wars in U.S. history were in the areas of the top, opium cultivation, opium poppy growing cultivation areas for producing heroin.
Right. Now we're talking about the primary production area would be in Afghanistan. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's the Golden Crescent area for poppy field cultivation. And that's become the largest supplier of opium and heroin in a century. It's incredible. That supplies probably 70 or 80% of the world's opium.
Now, there's this dark heroin that's coming in from South America. Is that correct?
Well, there is small percentages of the world's total opium does come from South America, and
But not that much in comparison to Afghanistan. Right?
No, we're talking about 2 or 3% of the world's opium opium production is in Central America or Latin America, I should say. Some 80% or more of opium that comes from that Golden Crescent, in Afghanistan.
Right. Okay, so now there have been experiences of our troops over there, our combat troops guarding some of those fields over in Afghanistan. I mean, there've been personal witnesses. Have you witnessed some of that? Have you documented some of that?
I haven't documented a lot of that. Just enough to show that that was a very strong reason for going into that war, because the Taliban, good or bad as they are, I don't really know. I do know what the mainstream press, I mean, New York Times and other Washington Post, said that the Taliban actually did outlaw poppy fields in the year 2000. And so for a year, the opium production in that area, in the Golden Crescent in Afghanistan, dropped to very little. We're talking like 5 or 10% of the world's production versus what it was before that, which was much higher, over 60% or more of the world's production. And so when they did that, that took so much opium off the market that it affected the coffers of the opium traffickers. And we, you know, the leading opium traffickers in history were U.S. and British intelligence. And these families I talked about at the beginning of our interview, you know, that were doing opium shipping from way back when with the British East India Company. And so the other thing it did is that it affected stock values when all of that laundered money is taken off the market too. And it really could have damaged the stock values on so many companies when there's such a huge drop in heroin sales. And so, you know, I argue that that could have been the reason for, you know, invading Afghanistan, besides also to get better access to certain oil fields. You know, the oil was probably part of the reason, too. There's always multiple reasons for wars, but an unknown reason is the drugs, you know, the heroin in that area. Another reason, of course, is oil. And Professor Peter Dale Scott wrote a good book, I think it's called something in effect of Opium, Oil, and Afghanistan, about those two major reasons for the war.
Yeah, Peter Dale Scott, I've met him several times at different conferences over the years, and he's quite a researcher.
Yeah.
And Arthur also.
Yes.
So what we've got is that we've got this going on. Oh, there is a point I'd like to make, too, is that the British East India Company, when that was beginning to build up, it was actually established in 1600, but I think much later is when they were doing the opium dealing into China.
Right.
But I believe those landed, titled aristocrats of England turned their noses up at that kind of money, a dirty money originally. But when the quantities of that, they had these British East India Company officials retiring back in England, bringing vast fortunes with them. And I think it changed the whole politics of England.
Yeah, I can believe that for sure. Yeah.
And it undermined it. So what some people have postulated is that you had the landed rich, the titled, came into a partnership with those opium British East India Company officials, and they started dominating the British politic from then on.
Yeah, I could see that. And
now, is that going to happen in this country through these Mexican cartels or not? What do you think?
Well, I think it already happened in the same evolution as it happened in Britain. It happened in the United States, except there was Cloward, that Richard, Professor Cloward I talked about studying with. He pointed out something interesting about the evolution of the United States versus the evolution of the European countries, and that is the fact that when the when you had the Industrial Revolution in the other countries, the nouveau riche rose up with the Industrial Revolution, and they were kind of opposed. You know, they were in opposition to the kind of the royalty that were already the wealthiest and most powerful in the country. So you have these superpowers of money and wealth against each other in Britain and Spain and France and all these different countries. Now, the United States evolved differently because there was no royalty. So when the nouveau riche rose up with the Industrial Revolution, they were the most power and they had no opposition. And in those European countries, when you had the two opposing powers, they both vied against each other and tried to get the workers on their side to oppose the other one. And that's the only thing that gave the workers any power in those countries. So that's why they got better workers' rights, more paid time off, better health care, you know, universal health care, much less expensive college education, all those things that we don't have here because of that evolution. And so I argue that here the evolution was just a little bit different than there, because there was just no royalty that could look down on the drug traffickers. They rose up without, you know, any royalty opposing them. And, you know, and they just took so much power and squashed, and, you know, anyone who opposed them at all. And that's why, you know, we have so much less of what Europe has.
Right. It, you know, when we get back, one of the points that I make sometimes is about monopolistic capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Or crony capitalism, you could
yeah.
say, or even they have designated it or described it as Babylonian capitalism, okay? Where it's capitalism, but it's only for the very few.
Right.
See what I mean?
Right, for the oligarchy. Yes.
And so when the left attacks capitalism, I think they sort of don't get that that monopoly of capitalism from the right. See what I mean?
Yeah, sure, sure. And I think...
Because, John, when I go back to this, I explain it in simple terms. A little dressmaker in San Antonio, Texas could be opening a storefront and making money, you know, selling dresses and having her friends sew and make some. That's pure capitalism. See what I mean? But when you move into what the giant institutions that it's evolved into now, but with the monopoly of the central banks and Federal Reserve systems, then we've got a big problem of fascism, actually.
Exactly. It's hyper-capitalism, or what you might call crony-capitalism, and it becomes, and it's probably fascistic, like you say. I agree.
So that's what we're up against now. That I begin to see the real battleground. And now you had 9/11, and that gave an impetus to attacking the Muslim, you know, and off we go on these wars again.
Right. And
so you're saying, go ahead.
No, I'm good. Were you guys?
You're saying that it's not only the drug dealing, but it's money. It's laundering that money through these banks that benefit tremendously from those additional profits, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then also they're supporting these wars because they own the munitions industries and military industrial complex. So it's a synergy of very debasing of the world. What do you think?
I agree with that completely. Sure. Yeah, I mean, they're profiting in so many ways, not just off the drugs, but also off the armaments made, no doubt. And the controlling the populations for their hyper-capitalist, you know, agenda, and no doubt. But I did want to say also that there's like dual ways that they were using these musicians. They were not just attacking their minds and killing them off when they opposed the Vietnam War or opposed other things that the oligarchy had an agenda for, but they were also using them to promote these drugs. And then doing away with them when they sobered up and started getting more into, leftist activism. So that's what we see, too, is that, of course, they manipulated Lenin and had him promoting some things inadvertently, not realizing he was, of course, promoting him because Lenin was trying to do a lot of good things in his life, his whole life. And but when Lenin sobered up more the most and was starting to do good things again, they, of course, did away with him, according to Fenton Bressler, an attorney and longtime legal reporter for the London Times, who did a 7-year study of John Lennon's murder, who concluded that the CIA assassinated him. And so I found they did the same thing with Jimi Hendrix and Cobain and Tupac Shakur and these other people on the cover of my book.
Right. The prescription drug problem today I didn't pick up on it in your book, and I probably missed it maybe, but it has become a tremendous problem. Prescription drugs now, are people getting hooked on those?
Yeah, well, it's the oxycodone, OxyContin type of drugs. I mean, lots of people, as a drug and alcohol counselor and a regular counselor, I just find I've heard a lot of stories of people going through operations given these certain painkillers that can be addictive and can hook some people onto them, and then the people end up turning to other drugs heroin, because they're both opiates, painkillers and heroin, both opiates. And so I'm finding some of that. I mentioned that in my book, but I don't get far into it just because it's my book is already about 450 pages, and I just
It's a tremendous book, John, and it was quite an undertaking, and you must be very proud of what you've accomplished here.
Yeah, I am. Thanks so much, George, for saying. Yeah.
And you really added a great deal and a lot of detail and a lot of background to what has evolved, that MK Ultra stuff and all this Hendrix stuff and Janis Joplin and things. And then you put the Nazis in there, too. Juan and Eva Perón, boy, they were avid supporters of Nazism.
Yeah, well, I heard that the Perones did help at certain times with the Nazis, but then they actually turned a little bit to doing some good. So they're a little bit of a mixed bag, but I agree they actually helped some of those German families that invited the Nazis into Argentina. I agree.
Okay, now what we're sitting on? We're sitting here at 2015. We've got the ISIS over there. we've got Syria still under attack. We still got that war and those things going on in Iraq and so forth, and a few things still in Afghanistan. Where do we go from here? What does your crystal ball see from here on? Yeah.
What I hope to do with this book is I hope to educate people enough. And of course, you know, I'm deluding myself to think that so many people will actually see my book or hear about the ideas of my book. But I'm hoping that enough people hear about the ideas of drugs as weapons against us that they turn away from drugs and they realize that, you know, that these drugs, that they're being duped and fooled into thinking that drugs are normal part of our lives to socialize with. And that, you know, they realize that, you know, some of them can cause full-fledged addictions and some of them can cause just even abuse issues that can and hurt their lives. And basically that most people get into more full-fledged activism in some way, shape, or form, while they're, you know, on the side of them doing their regular jobs and help change society for the better, that we can then, you know, find a clearer path to have tolerance to other people, to not be duped by all the American propaganda and the British propaganda and Western propaganda about, you know, these Muslims group rising up to behead all of us, you know, which is just absurd stuff. You know, there's a new, you know, boogeyman every day. You know, first it's Al-Qaeda, then it's ISIS, and you know, so whatever. It's just, it's such a joke. It sounds like, I mean, the leading evidence is starting to come out that ISIS was actually originally funded, some of the people originally funded by U.S. intelligence just as an excuse to topple Syria. So who knows for sure, though.
I've interviewed a man on the air two or three times that was an intelligence, Army intelligence in 2003, mm-hmm. north of Baghdad. He had Baghdadi under arrest in 2003.
Really? And that guy,
and he's head of ISIS. So I mean, we've got our fingers, and this thing about Syria is getting dangerous because of Russia. They're not letting, you know, go, and they're moving in some missile batteries that can really change the whole, you know, balance of the war over in Syria. This thing could be, it's continuing to build up. Ukraine and all these other things. I mean, it's a mess.
It's terrible. It's really terrible. I mean, it's unbelievable that we're trying to create a war with Russia and China. It seems like I can't even believe it. You know, it's just disgusting.
You know, the people meeting there at the Bilderberg, they'll be meeting beginning Thursday of this week.
Yeah.
They're meeting at the Inner Alpen Hotel there that's about 9 miles from Innsbruck, Austria. It's going to be interesting just to see. There's reporters over there right now, and they've already put out an agenda and topic list about what they're going to be talking about. But they're talking about all of this stuff, Ukraine, artificial intelligence, and all this other stuff. And it's just going to be interesting what leaks out of that meeting. But they have been more secretive this time, this year, than I've ever seen them before.
Yeah, one of the other authors on my publisher's press, Trinday, is that Daniel Estulin, and he wrote a great book about what really happens in the Bilderberg meetings. I think he got into one of those meetings once way back when, is my understanding. But I actually haven't gotten a chance to read his book fully. I just read about it a lot. It's incredible the power that these Western leaders have over the media because of, you know, people like Wargate Muckraker, Carl Bernstein is documented with this great article, CIA in the Media, that the Senate Church Committee found that well over 400 members of the media lived dual lives and they worked for the CIA. And they documented that these were the owners of all the media, not just regular journalists. And so with that kind of control and other forms of control over our media and our information, they can set the trends. They set the trends of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And, of course, we all like sex and rock and roll, but, you know, is it automatic that we all like drugs, you know? You know, there's some drugs maybe enjoy recreationally momentarily, but does drugs have to be a part of our lives for socializing, you know? So they set these trends, and they set the propaganda trends. They set the way we think to make us think we're acting in our own behalf and we're really acting the way that U.S. intelligence wants us to act. And so we just have to do what we can to get out of that, you know, propaganda cycle and think for ourselves against all this hyper capitalism, as you call it, as I agree, right. Crony capitalism that's going on now.
Right. You know, Austin was a center of the psychedelic movement. I don't know. The 13th floor elevators founded the psychedelic music movement.
Well, yeah, a lot of people think they're the founders. Like, yeah, a lot of people think Austin and 13th floor elevators, yeah, for where Erickson was the founder. Some people think San Francisco was the founder.
Yeah.
Dave Gowan makes a good argument that Los Angeles' Laurel Canyon was the founder.
Right.
But with L.A. and San Francisco, I document how U.S. intelligence was very involved in those areas.
Well, Rocky Erickson created that with his group here in Austin.
Yeah,
and it's called the 13th floor elevators. And they were the original founders of psychedelic. And Austin became a very big center for drug use here in this country.
Right. And I believe that. And I don't think it's... I don't think it's a coincidence that Austin is a very liberal town that's like against some of the hyper-capitalist ways of some other areas of Texas, you know.
Right.
And so I think they purposely try to couple the drugs and the psychedelics with the left-wing activism in order to hurt our minds and not allow us to be as good at our activism as we could normally be.
Well, you know, Charlotte Isherby wrote a book way back called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. And it seems like whether they've used ideas like changing images of men or drugs or whatever, or changing a big change in our school system and education system, it seems like the American population has been dumbed down to a degree. What do you think?
No doubt. You know, that's so obvious, you know, but it's great that she wrote a book documenting how it's done, but... It's just, you know, we can, you know, when I remember meeting Canadians back in the late 80s who said, dumb effing Americans, they called us, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah. Can't leave out the F word, can we? Oh, boy, I tell you. Yeah.
Yeah. Am I allowed to cuss this? Yeah. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on this show. But, yeah, it's the dumb effing Americans was the common language. And, yeah, you're right. You know, the Canadians, I don't think, are as dumbed down as much as the Americans. Though that might have changed recently with Harper and the conservative Harper in power. But, yeah, a lot of the other countries aren't as dumbed down as us, but they sure dumb us down, yeah.
Well, I like your premise of your book after looking at it and all the detail about how they manipulated all these people. Then maybe we can try to persuade these young people this is not the way. Drug use is not the way to go.
Yeah, I hope so, George.
And there's happiness there without drugs. You can get high on air, right? Whatever. Or a good cup of coffee, maybe, instead of drugs, right?
Right. Keep the sex and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And,
from
the drugs.
Well,
yeah.
Is there any last little comment you'd like to make before we sign off?
No, but if you want to find the book, it's pretty available at most places, but... you know, Amazon.com, of course, sells it, but I'd rather you, of course, you know, if you can get an independent bookstore, support your local independent bookstore if you can. If you don't have a local independent bookstore, then Barnes & Noble either will have it or they can order it and get it in the store within 2 to 4 days if you want to see it, you know, in your hand first and look at it before you buy it. But, you know, I hope people can read the book for themselves and look at the 1600 endnotes and see the sources and come to their own good decision.
Okay, we'll have all those click-offs up for you on this site.
Thanks,
John
so much,
Potash,
sure,
thank you very much, and thank you for all your hard work in this area.
You're very
welcome,
good night.
Good night.